Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Do you think promising to be back in black in a budgetary sense is dumb?
I think the promise that was made in terms of back in black was made at the time when you were looking at, you know, the immediate budget years. But in terms of the question, I think we all have to be cautious about how much we bake in promises dependent upon medium and long-term forecasts and projections.
Hello, lovely people of podcasts, and welcome to another episode of the show. You are with Catherine Murphy, and we are within days now of the most exciting day of the year. Simon Birmingham is smiling. Oh, no, he's laughing now. We're within sight of the federal budget next Tuesday, and if you're a regular listener, you'll know that Shane Wright, Greg Jericho and myself hashed over various probabilities last week in the pod cave. But rather than speculating, we've got the newsmaker with us this week, Simon Birmingham, who is the finance minister, and he's dropped in for a chat. Hello, Simon. Welcome.
Hi, Catherine. Great to be with you. And yes, indeed. I don't know whether it's the biggest day in everybody's life, but it's certainly a big day for the treasurer and for the finance minister, and you know, charts obviously the agenda of the government, not just for the next year, but well beyond.
No, exactly. It is important, which is why we're only joshing slightly. Now, finance for you is a new job, as I'm sure a lot of listeners know, that you were previously the Trade Minister, Matthias Cormann, who occupied the finance portfolio for seemingly 38 years, has now ascended in the direction of his job at the OECD, and you are the finance minister. So I'm just going to start with that. It's a new job.
It is a new job, and it's a pretty incredible and challenging time to step into the job, to be taking it on in the midst still of responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, hot on the heels of the first recession that Australia's faced in 30 years, with a budget position that is wildly different to anything that we had contemplated over the last few years, and all of those uncertainties, along with, in this budget, really the need as well to focus on a number of the other longer-term pressure points in the budget and to address those and guarantee we're getting on with delivering the services Australians want while keeping them safe from COVID, while keeping the economic recovery going, while keeping the jobs growth going. And so there's a lot of moving pieces.
Exactly. And we're going to get into all that. But just sticking with the job, and this might seem an odd question, but I'm genuinely interested. How do you prepare? Or is preparation a sort of stupid question to ask as a person who is as busy as you? It'd be sort of like if someone asked me, how do you prepare to do that? I would laugh because where would the extra hours in the day come from? But I'm genuinely interested, right? This is a key portfolio in any government, and we've seen some very formidable political figures come through the finance portfolio in the 20-something years I've been in the building. So how do you prepare, or does events basically preclude you from preparing for a transition like this?
I think it's the preparation of life and the preparation of career. And you know, I come in that sense having had the benefit of being a cabinet minister across a couple of different but busy portfolios previously in education and in trade, having served previously as a member of the Expenditure Review Committee of Cabinet, and some of that background all helps to at least have a sense of what you're stepping into. The preparation for a budget like this one is I guess, you know, very much the scan of the landscape at the earliest possible stages, and a lot of time between the Prime Minister, the Treasurer and myself canvassing, you know, what those pressure points and issues we think we're going to face in the budget are. And that conversation, you know, really starts at the back end of the year before the budget and continues the whole way through. And in this case, we're probably looking at an environment where, you know, there's more uncertainty as we hand down the budget in the global COVID context around, you know, outbreaks such as the tragedy in India, around the vaccine rollout, not just in Australia, but in many other countries of the world. And in that, you know, that's quite different to even how people thought the landscape would be just a few months ago. So, yes, there's the best of preparations, but then there is, of course, responding to events. And
well, you just need to get on with it, really, don't you?
Oh, there's always a deadline for the budget. You know, once the day is there, everybody just has to work towards that. But you've got to keep an eye to the long term. Yes, the budget has those short term essentials that you have to deal with in terms of pressure points. But you know, the decisions you're making, particularly in areas like responding to an Aged Care Royal Commission, are decisions that will have impacts for years and decades to come, just as indeed the work to drive the economy and create jobs has impacts on the individual lives of Australians for years and decades to come.
Yeah. I'm glad you raised aged care, because I sort of want to start, because we'll track towards the budget and expectations around what we might see next week. The Treasurer, I say this in the kindest possible way, has congratulated himself amply in recent times for getting through COVID without building in a lot of structural spending into the budget. There was obviously a massive fiscal response, a bigger fiscal response than I've ever seen in my reporting lifetime, rolled out during the pandemic. But a lot of it was what is a wash through the budget scenario rather than a structural spend. But when we look at the sort of the build up to the budget, as you've said, aged care, mental health, all really important social services for Australia, there you're getting into structural spending territory, right? You're building in spending over a longer term horizon. So just looking at what the budget is going to set up, because you've correctly framed this as not just one day, you know, Tuesday in May, but setting up something for decades hence, right? How much structural spending are we going to see baked into this budget? I don't mean a dollar figure. I mean, how much of that are we going to see? Or thinking about things like aged care, for example. There has been some discussion, for example, about reserving the increase in the superannuation guarantee to fund aged care. So more user pays, but sort of using elements of the retirement system in order to fund aged care. So I know this is a big question. It's sort of a ridiculously large question, but where is the budget going to sit in terms of structural spending, spending that the taxpayers pick up in terms of revenue that flows through into programs, user pays, other options? Where will all those balances sit?
Yeah, there's a lot of balances in that, and you fall back first and foremost on the principles that you have as a government that you think people have voted for you on and expect you to deliver against. And so, you know, in those, it is that for us, spending only what is necessary and doing so with a firm eye to how you guarantee the quality and effectiveness of it is important, which is why during the pandemic, the principles around ensuring that initial responses to it and continuing responses to it are temporary, they're targeted, they're proportionate. Okay? That's been the mantra from day one of response to COVID. It continues to be the case and will have to be the case as we keep dealing with those COVID uncertainties and maintain the confidence and strength that we've seen in the economy recently, but it's a confidence and strength that is set against a landscape of great global uncertainty, of risk of outbreaks, of challenges around vaccines, of all of those factors that require continued investment in the economic strength, because that is then what is going to provide the best basis for us to be able to fund and deliver the essential services that do have longer term cost implications. So if you go back to the last election, the Prime Minister said time and time again during that campaign that you needed a strong economy to deliver jobs for Australians and the essential services they rely upon. And that is still the core focus here, that we don't find means to pay for those essential services without having a strong economy that has Australians in jobs, that creates the virtuous cycle where you actually get, for every Australian who comes off of welfare and goes into the workforce, you've got reduced payments going out, more taxes coming in, stronger business returns that provide for higher company tax rates and so higher company tax returns and so on as well, all of which are how you can fund key services.
Yeah, no, I totally get you've got to run the economy hotter. I mean, this is very crude analogies, but you've got to run the economy hotter, both because we're in a manufactured recession in the sense of a government-induced recession, because for public health reasons, and the government is, there's still a lot of stimulus in the economy, and what you're saying is you need a strong economy, you need an expansionary fiscal policy to underpin that for the moment, right? But and then revenue is produced in order to fund services. But like aged care, let me draw you again on that superannuation point. Is that something that we might see in the budget where as well as stumping up X billion for aged care over the next 11 decades, because it's important, that then we might see some policy around user pays or some, like, is it all just dollars going out, or is there other mechanisms that?
So as a government, again, framed by those principles, a core one for us is to be a low-taxing government, and we have sought to drive and deliver that in terms of reduced income tax rates and reforms, which right now are providing a couple of billion dollars a month back into the pockets of Australians, again, underpinning that economic recovery. And we don't want to and don't intend to jeopardise the recovery or the confidence of Australian consumers or businesses by going down the path of additional taxes, levies, charges, or otherwise.
So no levy to fund aged care. So yeah.
Instead, making the spending decisions on the basis of looking at the long-term projections you've got in the budget and having the confidence that you are going to be able to drive the growth to be able to fund those sorts of decisions over a period of time. And that has clearly been a hard process as we've been going through. The stronger economic recovery that we've had to date obviously improves many of the factors and forecasts as has been outlined publicly. We will see in 2020, 2021, a lower than expected budget deficit because we've seen more Australians in jobs, paying taxes, lower drain and expectations in relation to costs around JobKeeper and JobSeeker recipients, and all of that, of course, putting us in a position then when you look forward at future projections of growth to ideally be able to make what we think are cautious and sensible decisions that are still necessary to respond to not just the report of the Royal Commission into aged care, but what Australians actually expect to receive in terms of high quality services in those
social
sectors.
Services. Yeah. So no levies, no taxes. But you haven't answered me on user pays. Is user pays part of the equation, or are we just looking at dollars going out the door? Which I'm sounding pejorative, which I don't actually mean pejoratively at all. I'm just I'm trying to conceptualise, because in your position in the finance minister's spot, you're the guy who has to monitor the dollars going out the door, to put it bluntly, right? And this appears to be quite a big spending budget. I'm wondering in my own mind, because obviously I haven't seen the document yet, whether this is actually a big spending budget, or whether we will see additional mechanisms other than spending in order to fund social services.
There are elements clearly that I'll be more at liberty to talk about after next Tuesday than I am before next Tuesday.
Yes,
anyway. And so that's always the challenge of doing interviews pre-budget.
Yeah.
But we, if you look at the aged care system in its current construct, there are already consumer contributions that are made. So people do make contributions towards residential aged care. They do face in certain areas contributions towards home care arrangements. And so it's been a key part of Australia's system to date.
Absolutely.
Just as in other ways, what works well for Australia is the fact that that government support and services operate in an environment of effective means testing, of ensuring that we are able to target support to those who ideally need it most. And by targeting in those sorts of ways, it enables us to keep taxes as low as possible as well and underpin that economic strength across the economy.
Mm.
We'll have a comprehensive response to the Aged Care Royal Commission. It, as I said, will be true to our principles in terms of keeping costs, levies, taxes low across government, but still delivering on those services. And yes, as Finance Minister, I've had to look very carefully at what spending projections mean for the future, but we do that in the full context of the overall economic projections and how we see the ability to be able to fund those services to have a long-term trajectory towards budget repair once we've got sufficient economic strength post the recession and post COVID, and in a sense, in terms of the costs of deficits at present, to also fully appreciate that we're operating in a very low interest rate environment, where despite the growth in debt, which we take seriously, the cost of servicing that debt right now is actually less than it was a couple of years ago.
And growth, if there's enough growth in the system too, that reduces the size of the debt relative to the economy. That's another factor, as well as low borrowing costs.
They're the important factors that, again, the budget will outline some of those projections around debt as a proportion of GDP and the way in which the recovery that's underway and the forecasts. If you look at what's publicly available from the Reserve Bank, their optimism about where they see unemployment getting to and the continued strength they see in the Australian economy, they become factors that help to drive a stronger budget position that enables you to fund these sorts of services.
Sure. Are we likely, debt, just moving from debt to deficit quickly, if you run the economy hot enough, are we likely to see some sort of track back to surplus over the forward estimates, or is it beyond the forward estimates? Like, I'm thinking about year four. Are we balanced or close to balance? Like, is that ridiculous or is that actually possible?
People shouldn't be building up too many expectations whilst we're still dealing with the COVID situation and seeing a rapid return in terms of budget
sounds
balance.
Sounds like no to balance in year four.
If you look at the budget projections that were outlined in the budget last year, in MIEFO at the end of last year, they still show continued deficits running out over a significant period of time. We've got all the uncertainties, I said before, around COVID, and we need to invest to maintain confidence, and we need businesses across Australia to invest to maintain confidence in the economy whilst we're dealing with those COVID uncertainties and we're making these sorts of decisions in relation to the way in which we support and fund services for the future. So it's a challenging fiscal environment and it remains quite challenging, and it's why each of these decisions has to be weighed very carefully.
Sounds like no.
Well, again, I'm not going to give full speculation in terms of what the budget bottom line will say, these are difficult circumstances in which to run a budget that keeps the economy strong in the face of uncertainty and starts to deliver even more in terms of the services Australians expect.
Will there be any substantial savings measures in this budget? Any at all?
We're always looking for ensuring spending is of appropriate quality. And so that's a constant process across every portfolio, and oftentimes it's the best saving is the dollar that you haven't spent. because you've been able to identify ways to achieve outcomes more efficiently or more cost effectively. But sometimes there are opportunities for savings. As a government, though, we've worked pretty hard over a long period of time to ensure there's efficiency across the public service and across spending programs, and we'll keep reinvesting in terms of finding new ways to achieve that efficiency. And today's announcement by the Prime Minister in the digital economy strategy that sees investments in some of the systems that run MyGov and health records for Australians ultimately help to drive further efficiencies.
Efficiencies.
You know, they take time to be realised, and they often require upfront efficiencies, but many of the systems we have invested in recent years, for example, in the social services space, are starting to see reduced foot traffic into Centrelink sites around the country as people are now better able more easily to engage in the online systems to update their information and require less of that face-to-face contact. So you know, these are things you invest in today to yield sometimes dividends quite some time into the future.
Oh, no. And all of that tech, you know, sitting behind the government, some of it's so antiquated, it's, you know, it's practically non-functional. So it's good. It's good to see those investments. You might get better looking numbers through efficiencies, but we're not in a I'll frame this as a question rather than a statement. We're not in a normal, you know, outside COVID budget round where people have to offset expenditure. So this, hence my question. It's sort of like, I don't know how many budgets I've covered where there might be $1 billion booked to, you know, efficiencies in data matching, for example, or, you know, those sort of savings. Are we likely to see any of that in the budget? I'm not asking you to give me a measure because you obviously can't do that. I'm just for the listeners trying to frame expectations ahead of next week. So are we likely to see anything like that?
We've certainly looked for savings where we can and where it's economically responsible to do so and consistent with the delivery of the services that we want. And so it's not completely bereft of savings. You would expect governments, as you make decisions, to prioritise along the way. But you know, we're also a government that got ourselves in the position of a budget balance pre-COVID because of responsible spending decisions that had shown restraint, had made some savings along the way, but overwhelmingly as well because of the fact that we'd achieved a position of welfare dependency at some of its lowest levels, workforce participation at the highest possible levels. And even in this budget, you can see the benefits coming through from that with an extra 200,000 Australians in work relative to what had previously been forecast. That means our payments are down by $3 billion. Our tax revenues are up by $2 billion. And that's ultimately how you achieve the sustainable strength in the budget for the long term.
Mm. Back to surpluses in the out years, which I guarantee I'm not obsessed with, because I think one of the good things about you know, this sort of terrible shock that's been visited on the world in terms of the pandemic and the aftermath is that we're having a more sensible conversation about debt and deficit. You know, in the olden times, the life of your own government, we had hysterical budget emergencies and all kinds of stuff that happened. I'm not inviting you to comment on that, but it really was hysterical and hyperbolic. Now we're in a sort of more, what I would call fact-based conversation about debt and deficit and the sustainability of budgets, right? But obviously you're Mr. No in the government. You are the finance minister. That's the role you play. You're the guy who has to turn down the spending proposals or furrow your brow or whatever, send the colleagues packing. That's part of the role, right? So, but in terms of back in black promises, right, we've seen Wayne Swan, you know, said, oh, we'll be back in surplus rolling out of the GFC. And it didn't happen. And it was problematic for Labor politically. Your own government said, we're back in black, you were in balance, but obviously then COVID hit. I'm not blaming you for COVID, but I'm just saying, right, everybody gets impaled on their promises eventually, right? Do you think promising to be back in black in a budgetary sense or a surplus in a particular year or something of that nature is dumb?
I think the promise that was made in terms of back in black was made at the time when you were looking at the immediate budget years.
No, no, I know. I'm not spearing you for that. But in terms of the question, I think
we all have to be cautious about how much we bake in. Promises dependent upon medium and long-term forecasts and projections. That is obviously ripe with uncertainty. People expect once we're forecasting the next year or two in normal times for us to have, barring extreme global events, a fair degree of certainty around what you're going to actually be able to deliver as a government over that 1 or 2 year time period. And so I think actually, yes, throughout the life of our government, we had, up until the pandemic, a firm focus on budget repair, but we were always cautious in terms of the final declaration of when the budget would go to surplus until we were within that 1 to 2 year horizon of seeing a surplus. And we did hand down effectively a balanced budget that then had credible surpluses forecast.
I'm not being passive aggressive. I'm genuinely interested. Yeah,
but we're now in a situation where we're to put a timetable clearly in terms of what you're going to, the year in which you might hit surplus. I think people would question, is that really credible, given all of the uncertainties you're currently dealing with and given the many steps that that will have to be made to get back to that point. But it doesn't mean that it isn't important to strive to get back to that point.
No, I'm not.
At the right time it will be, because Australia's relative position to the rest of the world has held us in good stead through COVID. The confidence that bond markets have to invest in Australia and to support the revenue raising in Australia is something that is partly underpinned by the fact that we have AAA credit ratings, that we have low debt relative to other countries, and that despite the huge outlays we've made, we maintain those projections of lower debt relative to other nations. It also enables us to come through this recovery period without having to pursue higher taxes that can impede the recovery. Which in other countries, including other developed countries, you're seeing governments having to hike back up taxes, which will hit confidence and will risk stalling parts of the recovery in that regard.
But I think you've answered it just more politely than words I would pick. I think you are basically telling me politely that it is dumb, really, in the current environment to make any sort of a promise that you could subsequently be impaled upon. Is that again, stupid question to ask because I'm not asking you to reveal confidences, even though I'm going to bowl this question up in that frame. Is that a political conversation that the government has been cognizant about? It's just very striking to me because I've lived through the GFC and the aftermath. I've lived through the back in black period, which then COVID smacked us. It just strikes me that these promises are diabolically bad for whomever makes them, right? So...
Which is the point I was making before, is why I think we were quite cautious through all of those years early period in government in terms of setting a hard, concrete year and marker as to when it would be achieved. We knew it would be a hard slog and that it could be beset by uncertainties. But if a once-in-a-century global pandemic doesn't change, indeed, things dramatically, then potentially nothing will, and it certainly has changed things dramatically, and it does put us in a position where we have to be honest about the uncertainties that we face. I think we laid out very clearly in last year's budget and the mid-year update a couple of months later that the fiscal strategy was stage one, continued economic recovery, jobs recovery, and driving the unemployment rate towards those theoretical levels of full employment. Stage two would then be about how you achieved fiscal repair once you'd achieved stage one. Nothing has changed really in terms of the type of strategy, as Josh outlined in his fiscal speech last week. We're still really working towards the stage one objectives. They're going much better than we had projected or that the economic commentators had anticipated, but they're by no means baked, done and dusted and able to be relied upon. And we have to keep working at stage one, particularly now you've got the Reserve Bank and Treasury reassessing where they see that level of full employment and necessitating us to push, you know, a bit harder towards that theoretical level too.
One more budget question before we go to your parliamentary staff responsibilities.
You make it two or three if you like.
You're going to enjoy it that much. I'm interested just picking up on this idea about promising and signalling on budget repair. Obviously, the coalition's constituency. I mean, there's a reason why we had the hyperbole of the Abbott era in terms of budget emergencies and so on. You are appealing to your core, to your base, to your core constituency who thinks that budget repair is important. Because you've done this amazing shape shift, right, during the pandemic. I mean, I'm not sort of being pantomimish about that, because you did what the country required. You did what was in the interests of the economy and people. But if you think about the plot line from Tony Abbott to Scott Morrison standing up in the courtyard spending $10 billion a week or whatever, that's quite a trajectory, right? How are your constituency, your base, dealing with the idea that you very sensibly in this conversation say we've got to put, you know, we can't put hard promises on a return to surplus because of conditions, and we've got to run the economy hard and we've got to pay for services and all that sort of stuff. How are they going with that in terms of that shape shift?
I think what we will be seeking to drive home out of the budget and the policies we're rolling out in the period beyond is still the message of responsibility in the decisions we've made to keep people's jobs safe and secure, to keep the economy safe and secure, and to keep them safe in a health context as well. But also the responsibility around the quantum and quality of spend that we seek to make as well. And in that, I think we will still see quite a strong contrast when it comes to the next election. I've seen some of the commentary that Anthony Albanese is going to try to create himself as an economic conservative.
Spending must stop.
I'm yet to see an area in which he's proposing that we reduce our spending rather than spend more. At each step in relation to JobKeeper, the opposition was predicting doom and gloom and saying we should spend more, and yet the evidence seems to indicate that we have managed that transition down and out of JobKeeper quite successfully and without the type of catastrophe that was forecast. Although Labor has a pretty bare policy cupboard to date, give them credit, they do have some policies out there on childcare, and of course we've announced some policies on childcare in relation to the next budget. And again, there's a stark and striking contrast between the Coalition and the Labor Party. You know, we have outlined policies on childcare that are carefully targeted and proportionate to what we see as the challenges the system faces, which is, you know, how do we support those Australian families where there is a clear barrier in the cost of childcare to access the choice of going back into the workforce or working more hours. And we're doing that through two key measures: abolishing the cap that acts as an impediment to some in working a third or fourth day, and increasing support in relation to a second child in childcare for those who see that as a real barrier. Labor's proposal, spending many billions of dollars extra than us, is of course to actually increase the rate of subsidy dramatically to families on the highest income. High-income families for whom the cost of childcare is far less likely to be a barrier to making those choices around workforce participation. And so I think the quality versus the recklessness of spending will remain very much a coalition versus a Labor proposition going into the next election. And I'll be very surprised if Anthony Albanese's policies can live up to today's thought bubble rhetoric around economic conservatism.
I'm quite interested in that. I mean, obviously you would say that, Simon. You would say that there is still a sharp contrast between you and your political opponents in terms of quality of spending, right? Of course, you would say that. I haven't really thought about it, so maybe you're right. But I think that contest closes, though, if you're both in territory where you're both recognising that funding services is important. anyway, I think that's a watch this space that you and I might actually return to as the election gets closer, because I'm sort of quite interested in that conceptually. But anyway, I don't want to bog us down. Staff. I know you're thrilled, but we've got to do staff, because that's obviously an important part of the finance minister's responsibilities.
They're serious issues.
Yeah, well, they are serious issues. And I think you and I would agree that this, neither of us have lived through a few months like the last few months have been in this building. I think we'd be a unity to get on that.
Yeah, look, at they were an incredibly challenging period of time, and I think at a couple of levels I found it most challenging. One was clearly the individual cases and knowing some of the terrible things that people had gone through and had not necessarily felt that they had the support to be able to address and respond to in the way that they should. Then the other is also the broader ramifications that are an image and a perception of the workplace and environment being created that then reflects so challengingly on everybody else coming to work, and that at some of those real crisis points you had people who should be proud to work in the Parliament of Australia probably feeling dispirited, despondent, and maybe even ashamed at turning up to work.
Completely. And,
and so making sure that the settings and the standards and the protections that we have in place into the future are such that that we give everybody the workplace that they should have, but also create an environment where we can attract the best and brightest to work here, and that they have pride in doing so are very important ambitions to me, and I think ambitions that I genuinely shared across the political divide when I speak with colleagues, as I have in consulting, on how we respond to some of these issues.
Absolutely, and I think that is that's a useful point to make, because it's been a bit obscured. I think there's been different distress levels in the building. That there've been the distress levels of people who have had terrible experiences and are either prepared to talk about them or not. And then there's the distress level of people who have not had terrible experience and have not perpetrated any improper behaviour on anyone and are dealing with feelings of isolation and shame and embarrassment at being perceived in a workplace that, the Australian public now considers entirely dysfunctional. So
That's right. And in no way underplaying the gravity of dealing with the serious issues that are there. But I do think it's important, and you would have many political staff who tune into the podcast, and hello to you all. The message I'd want to give to them is that whether you're working for the government or the opposition or a minor party, we do know that the vast majority, nearly everyone, frankly, turns up, gives their all, works incredibly hard, and is deserving of the respect, certainly of the members of Parliament and senators who have the honour of working in this place, but frankly, probably the respect that they may never really get an acknowledgement from the rest of Australia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we rely on parliamentary staff as much as we do the public service to make sure that that the country is well run.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm glad you said that. I think that's quite important, because there are a lot of people who have been in all kinds of distress. So thank you for saying that. In terms of, though, we got a big agenda going forward, and please don't throw a blanket on this by saying we've got the Jenkins inquiry. I'm genuinely interested in your view. Without preempting what Kate Jenkins comes up with at the end of a no doubt very rigorous process and a widely consultative process, I think everybody agrees that the HR function in this building governing political staff is inadequate. The power relationships are wrong. That staff in this building don't have normal workplace HR powers that I would have. If I bully my team in here, any of them could go to the editor and complain about me, could go to HR and complain about me. Normalised processes like that do not cover parliamentary staff. Do you think if Kate Jenkins comes up with a recommendation at the end of this that we need a more normalised HR function and we need it to be independent from principals such as yourself in offices who are the employers of these people, do you think that the government's going to have the bottle to go for that? Because it's a big, big shift in the power dynamic.
Yeah, look, I think there is a firm willingness to look at anything that Kate recommends with very much an open mind and to work through those issues. It is a unique workplace on a range of levels, and its unique aspects start with the fact that constitutionally you've got 227 effective employers as members of parliament and senators put into this building who are voted on by the Australian people, put here and empowered in a constitutional position to hold that office and hold that office until such time as the Australian people remove them. It's not quite a normal workplace where the boss is ultimately subject to practices that are not protected by a constitution and to normal workplace laws. And so they are some of the challenges I know that Kate will grapple with in terms of her recommendations and the work that she does. But there are the cultural issues and then the practice issues to address, and clearly they're interconnected. And you achieve effective change by making sure that culture changes, and that changes by virtue of a range of things. And accountability is one of those. Training and expectations around workplace management are some of those. And I would fully expect that Kate will come up with recommendations seeking to have an arrangement in dealing with workplace bullying, sexual harassment, assault, and otherwise that clearly expects more in terms of how people are trained, including members and senators, the transparency and accountability of processes to handle complaints and issues, and the independence of those processes along the way, and that we will have to respond in a constructive way to those recommendations. But I also know that Kate understands the difference in this workplace, just as her other reviews, and it's why we've got her to do this work, have other unique factors. When she did work for the Australian Defence Force, again, chain of command principles and so on are clearly important in a Defence Force.
Yeah.
She had to weigh those. She's just completed her work in relation to Gymnastics Australia.
Yeah, I haven't read that yet. That looks amazing. Mm.
And, again, sporting organisations, a lot of volunteer engagement and so on. Again, different parameters as to how you handle the response. But ultimately, culture and then the practices that drive that culture are what you've got to achieve the optimal outcomes for in any of these environments, and the parliament should be one that sets the highest of standards for the rest of the country to follow, and that's the aspiration.
Mm. Last question, and I don't mean this as a personal question, even though it's about you. It seems sort of stupid thing to say, but you'll understand what I mean by this. I don't. Has the events of the last few months made you, an employer in your office, responsible for the welfare of people, has it made you check yourself?
I think it's absolutely given cause for self-reflection. There's been a publicised case in relation to somebody who used to work in my office, who subsequently went to the media some years after leaving my employment, and that was the first that I'd learnt of apparent issues that had occurred outside of the workplace but between two former staff. And obviously sort of reflecting on that personal case and the breadth of other issues, you think about, well, how and what can I do, as well as how do I build a better system that would give somebody the confidence to come to me or to go to an independent voice at a much earlier stage when issues can be resolved and when help can be provided, rather than the prospect of years later it bubbling up in the media and everyone thinking, well, how do you provide a resolution at this point in time? And I've had the opportunity to talk to that former staff member and to a number of others with personal cases along the way, and they, you know, they do confront you and cause you to as I say, self-reflect and think, well, you know, how could I do better? As at the same time as you're thinking, as the finance minister, how do I ensure the system does better in
does
the future
as well? Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, because clearly you are not an ogre.
But hopefully not.
No, well, clearly you're not, right? But yeah. And I wasn't.
Not that there's anything wrong with Shrek either. Sorry.
Seems reasonable 30 minutes in really to get to a Shrek reference. But no, you're not an ogre. You're not known for being an ogre. That wasn't a passive way of me asking you about Chelsea Potter. I meant it in a broader sense. I would ask anybody in this room at the moment, Ryan. But you did raise Chelsea Potter's incident though. So it's, Have you changed anything?
I've had numerous discussions, you know, with my staff, and frankly, and they're probably discussions that I've not historically had in terms of both trying to remind of the standards that are expected. Although I like to think that the people who've worked in my office have had a strong appreciation of the standards and ethics expected through the years, but also the supports that are available and the options that are available to them, and probably have had more upfront conversations across my ministerial office and my electorate office about what those options and what those choices are for people, so that they know that it's not just an internal option, that there are external options for help and support and investigation available to them, but also internally that they know that there are a range of choices in terms of who they can talk to and who has an understanding of the systems that that are in place. And look, I have no doubt that there's plenty more that I can learn, and you know, I'm grateful for the fact that Kate Jenkins has agreed to do this work, because in working alongside of Kate, although her review is completely independent, she has all the powers to make her own recommendations, but in working alongside her, I've got no doubt that there'll be plenty more that I'll learn that may well influence my practices in this job or whatever I do in the future too.
Yeah, and I stress I wasn't setting this up as a personal self-criticism anyway. Thank you. It's the week before budget. You've just made 40 minutes to have a decent conversation with me. I'm very grateful for that.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you to Miles Martignoni, who is the executive producer of this show. Thank you to Hannah Izzard, who often cuts it. Thank you to you guys for listening. Do all the usual things, tell your friends, etc. Share the podcast around. Budget week next week, we'll be back then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.